This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. If you've ever stood on the rim of the Grand Canyon, you've stared into nearly 2 billion years of Earth's history. And if you visited Meteor Crater in northern Arizona, you've seen the violent aftermath of a cosmic collision. They seem like very different stories. One carved slowly by water, the other blasted open in seconds by a meteorite traveling tens of thousands of miles per hour.
But what if these two iconic landscapes are more closely connected than we thought? Science writer Evan Howell explores that connection in his new article in the recent edition of the High Country News titled, "The Grand Canyon and Meteor Crater Have a Surprising Link." It's a story that ties together planetary impacts, deep geologic time, and the dynamic forces that continue to shape the Colorado Plateau. Evan Howell, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
All right. Thanks, Lynn. Scott, I appreciate you having me.
Thanks for joining us. I remember as a kid going to the Meteor Crater in Arizona. It was such, well, literally, it's such an impact. It's about, what, a mile across and about 500 feet deep. I don't know how many people in their lives have visited this place, but it really strikes you as, wow, this happened to see it. I don't know why we went there on a family trip, you know, Winslow, Arizona.
Yep.
But the connection, how far is Marble Canyon from the crater, roughly? I looked it up, and I'm thinking it's somewhere on the order of 100 miles.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I think it's 100, 130 miles.
That just sets the stage for the distance that this geological impact, the impact it could have had on something in the Grand Canyon. So maybe you let that story unfold for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I won't bury the lead. The story, and we should acknowledge that this was written in High Country News, and this is based on a study led by Carl Carlstrom, who's a professor emeritus out of the University of New Mexico, so recently retired. So this is not my work. I'm just the reporter and the science writer kind of talking through this. But basically what Carlstrom and his many co-authors were able to at least propose. Now, they'll always be careful to say, you know, this isn't proof, but they propose that when that meteor impact kind of collided with Earth right around 56,000 years ago, that triggered a landslide in this very remote part of the Grand Canyon called Marble Canyon. You kind of stuffed all these boulders down into the canyon, and that slowly filled up to form this very deep lake. I think reached maybe, I believe, about 300 feet above the current lake level and filled all the way back up to Lee's Ferry, which may not be a name familiar to most people, but if you ever go and raft the Grand Canyon, that is the famed kind of starting point where you can drive across Marble Canyon. And then so that lake slowly filled up, actually rather quickly probably filled up, maybe over hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, and then at some point gave way catastrophically, suddenly, slowly, we don't know, and that lake obviously no longer exists, and it's just the Colorado River.
Well, I'm wondering if you could just take a minute to walk us through the actual science behind the meteor crater and what happened around, what was it, I guess, 50,000 years ago, and what makes it such an important research site? Why do we care about it?
Yeah, I guess I'd back up quickly. Just for folks who've been to the Grand Canyon, I think 90% roughly of the visitors go to the South Rim. And that's where you had the famed overlooks, people everywhere with selfie sticks, kind of crowded in the summer. Now, Marble Canyon is a completely different area. And it's actually quite special to me because it's this kind of almost like elephant trunk kind of extending off the main canyon. It's this tight, narrow, kind of sinuous canyon. If you take a look on Google Earth, you'll see what I'm talking about. It kind of extends off to the northeast, a very remote area compared to the rest of the park. So just to kind of set the scene. And so in the 1960s, this would have been even quieter. And Carlstrom's father, oddly enough, Thor Carlstrom, was also a geologist. So it kind of runs in the family. And he was based out of Flagstaff, I believe. And so they came to this remote area in the 60s as a sort of interdisciplinary research group. I believe it was mostly in search of cultural artifacts, so archaeologists, folks of that nature. And they were digging into these and kind of like going through Marble Canyon. And they knew of these caves. I think one of them, Stanton's Cave, I believe it's called, is the most famous one. And so there were whisperings of maybe artifacts or things in these caves. So they go in there And Thor Karlstrom notices all this kind of loose sediment. Because obviously the whole Grand Canyon is sedimentary rock, but it's stone. And in these caves, there's looser sediment that suggests it's much younger. And within that sediment are chunks of, or just big hunks of driftwood, knots of wood and all this stuff. And so they're like, wait a second, you know, we're way over the river here. This is way too high to be a flood. And over the years, that kind of coalesced into some sort of lake hypothesis. But it was really kind of hard to prove. They're downstream at, I believe it's, yeah, Mankoweep Canyon, downstream in Marble Canyon, was kind of, maybe if you squint and looked at it, was evidence of maybe a landslide. There were some boulders. But it was, you know, it was real kind of arm wavy in geologic parlance. Like, oh, you know, if you squint real hard, you can maybe see a landslide. So it kind of, it just kind of sat there for decades. 70s, 80s, time goes on. There's sort of this lake hypothesis, but not a lot to it. Now, fast forward many years later, and there is a team, I believe mostly based out of Australia and maybe New Zealand as well. I may have the affiliations a little off there, but they're playing with new radiocarbon dating methods. And they get a hold of this wood, which had been, I think, settled at, let me see here. I think it had been about, at the time, 43,700 years is what it had changed over the years as the technology was being updated, and it was right around 44,000 years old. And they were interested for another reason at that time level. There was something about that time level that interested them. But when they re-ran this wood, it actually showed that it was around 56,000 years old. Now, just a few years ago, Lynn, you talked about being on a road trip. One of these researchers, one of the international researchers, had come to U.S., been on a road trip with a family, and sat in on a film at Meteor Crater, where they talked about the science, you know, for tourists. And they mentioned that one of the proposed dates of the meteor impact was right around 56,000 years old. And so this fellow perks up, was like, whoa, hold on, wait a second. That's the date of that wood we have. And so there seemed to be this coarse alignment on the dates of the meteor impact and the driftwood, you know, 100 miles away in the canyon. And so they're like, well, we need someone who knows the canyon. And so that's when they called up Carl Karlstrom, who spent much of his career kind of in nooks and crannies all throughout the canyon, trying to uncover the history of its erosional history, all kinds of stuff in there. And Carl works from the very ancient Precambrian past all the way up to modern. And so he was the guy to call. So they started putting a better case together, finding more caves, more sediment, more driftwood, bringing in more dating methods. They could actually date the sediment itself and see when it was last exposed to sunlight. That's called luminescence dating. And so they could say, hey, this sediment's buried so long. And all those dates started to coalesce because they were really stretching so radiocarbon really starts to fall off after about 50,000 years. And much beyond that, people call it just radiocarbon dead. It's just a hard no. We just don't know. It's something older than that. So they were really stretching radiocarbon to call it 56,000 years. So they wanted to bring in some other dating methods to help kind of triangulate that. And so they put together a really nice case. So that's kind of the more or less, we can get into more details if you like, but that's kind of the big picture science behind all this.
Yeah, and what's 6,000 years among friends in carbon dating?
Well, I'm sure you can go to a conference and get people yelling a lot. So maybe it doesn't get so friendly, yeah.
I want to make sure I understand this.
Yeah.
Connection then between this meteor impact and the artifacts that were found in the caves in the Grand Canyon was driftwood? Was there driftwood that came from the meteor? I am trying to connect the dots here for not just our listeners, but myself as well.
Oh, yeah, great question. So the hypothesis then began that you couldn't get driftwood and sediment so high above the river. It was way too high. So you needed some sort of body of water to be filling up high enough. So one theory at the time was, well, maybe this driftwood was just left behind as the cave was carved. You know, because obviously the cave's river's carving down the canyon, rather, not the cave. And it could just leave driftwood and sediment in the caves as the river's carving down into the canyon. But those dates don't align. Karlstrom and many others have done a lot of work on when the canyon was carved in this area, and they just couldn't make the pieces fit. So they were just scratching all these other scenarios of how you could get driftwood and sediment high into a cave so high above the river. And really the only solution that was left was that you had to have a lake. And then the more tenuous link was linking that to the crater. I think the science that the lake was there is certainly much more strong than the link to the canyon, because then you all these dates, so we can get into this, all these dates have error bars. So you can't say with radiocarbon that this happened on April 3rd, you know, 1948 or something like that. There's always error bars on that. So for a crater and a lake to be linked, you almost need it down to the day or hour. And so there will always be a little bit of mystery based on our current understanding of these ages. Does that answer your question, Scott?
Yes. Thank you.
I'm
starting to get the picture now. And I think the driftwood being the big link here is kind of interesting. And I would love to find out a little bit more. I mean, I kind of wish carbon dating was, you know, could go back millennium. Obviously, it can't yet. But I think maybe as the technology improves in the future, we're going to get a more clear picture, as you said, maybe down to the hour or you know, the day.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, there's some just physical limits because it is based on the decay of carbon isotopes. I think isotopes, boy, I'm gonna make sure I'm staying in my lane here. I'm just a writer. I have a geology background, but it's been a while. But then other toolkits become useful in deeper time. Now, maybe you can't date organic material. You have to start looking at the rock and things around it. So there's so many toolkits for dating as you get further back in time. And there are many. There are many. Yeah.
So this story is just fantastic. I was reading High Country News and I came across your article and I just thought, first of all, wow, that it, I guess that it took this long to find the link. But also, I mean, I've been on many river trips where, especially in the, I haven't been in the Grand Canyon on a river trip, where you do see the driftwood up so high and you think, you know, on the walls of the river and you think, now what could have happened here? Was this a flood? Was it at some point a lake? But the really startling thing here is that it was about 150 feet up above the level of the canyon, the bottom of the canyon. Right. Is that right?
Well, it depends where you are because the canyon's getting deeper as you go. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So I guess it surprises me that the inquiry had never taken place before because people have been exploring the Grand Canyon for many, many decades. Was it Carl Carlstrom, until he got the call to go investigate this, had he done any inquiry into the sediment per se?
Yeah, he was aware of the lake hypothesis, and I have a quote in here of him expressing skepticism early on. There was another geologist, I think it's Richard Hereford, I believe is his name, in the 80s was the first one to propose the lake hypothesis mostly based around Stanton's Cave and so it was the Stanton's Cave driftwood and sediment and then this dam proposal at Nankoweap. And so it was just two pieces of evidence. And, you know, so I have this quote of Carlson saying, you know, I never believed his story, frankly. So he had skepticism for a long time. But then when these dates started to align and he dedicated more time himself amongst these researchers going through the cave, finding more and more, or I keep saying cave, going through the canyon, finding more and more caves, nooks and crannies filled with sediment, filled with more driftwood, they started to put together a profile saying, okay, there's only one thing that could get... So I guess I'll back up. Carl has worked a lot on floods, and it's actually become kind of a controversial topic amongst, are these some of these kind of biblical floods, things like that. And Carlstrom's done a lot of work showing that many of these were Holocene age floods, which I believe is right around the last 12,000 years or so. So there are big floods in the Grand Canyon, but they are too young to match with this lake history. So anyway, over the years, I think this was the early 2020s when they were out doing this research, he just started, him and the team started finding more and more of these caves, more and more evidence to suggest, man, there's something that had a high water mark here that we really can't explain with any other processes. And he also had a great quote in here. I don't remember it exactly. I don't have it in front of me, but it was more along the lines of, you know, in geology, we don't prove things per se. We just eliminate other possibilities and kind of end up with a story that makes sense that you can't explain any other way. And that's me paraphrasing terribly, but that was more or less his statement. And it's true.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, in part, it's the scientific method, right?
Right.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science writer Evan Howell. We're talking about his article in the recent issue of the High Country News. He's talking about geologist Carl Carlstrom and his colleagues who concluded that the meteor crater in Arizona shook Marble Canyon in the Grand Canyon hard enough to dislodge great chunks of stone and create a dam. Well, it really is testament, isn't it, Evan, to the power of water that that dam, you know, no longer exists. And it's funny because when you kind of compare a dam like that to like the Glen Canyon Dam, you realize what it takes to engineer a dam that's going to last, right?
Absolutely.
Have they been able to find any evidence? I guess you wouldn't be able to find evidence of, you know, where the rocks are now that created the dam, where these huge chunks are.
Yeah, so if you go to Nankoweap Canyon, I mean, I saw some of the images in the study itself, and you can, I've got a link to the study in this article if you want to, for those who are interested. There are images from that area of these kind of boulder deposits that roughly look like a dam. But you're right, we don't know, you know, as best I can tell from the reporting of all the people I talked to for this story, there really is no verifiable history of what happened to this dam. You know, how long did it last? Did it fail catastrophically, as many natural dams do, which is not a good thing you want to be downstream of, because all of a sudden you have a lot of water rushing your way violently. And it did bring up the conversation amongst many sources of the modern dams that we have. And every modern dam does fill with sediment. Every dam fills with sediment. Every dam is eventually topped by water once it fills with sediment. And so every dam has its lifespan, even the modern ones. And so that conversation came up a lot. And so it felt like a good way to end the story, which is how I did. It makes us think of, we live, and it kind of ties into geologic time for me as well. As having a geologist background, I'm often thinking about how impermanent everything we understand to be is. We live lives that, if we're lucky, maybe are 100 years. We're usually thinking a week at a time. We're maybe thinking about our grandkids' lifetimes at best. But geologic time is so much deeper, so much more profound, and everything we think is permanent won't last. And maybe that sounds depressing, but to me, it's important to keep that frame that even these modern dams, you know, we'll have to either work on them or they'll change and pass. And it was just an interesting way to end the article for me.
It just strikes me that I'm thinking about the rock and roll lyric, "We're just dust in the wind."
It is. We are dust in the wind. You're right.
So does this connection between these two geological phenomena, the meteor and, of course, the Grand Canyon, does that change how we think about maybe the Grand Canyon's history or even about the broader geological story of the American Southwest?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, the Grand Canyon has so much history. I mean, sedimentary rocks themselves are these wonderful archives of history, and almost nowhere on Earth do we have such a continuous record. We have rocks there, don't quote me on the ages, but they're pre-Cambrian, you know, over a billion years, I'm pretty sure, all the way up to, I think, the rim of the canyon is still in the Paleozoic, so still quite old. But we have hundreds of millions of years of history there, and then all this younger history imposed upon that, so things like this lake. And it just seems like, having lived in Flagstaff, I always heard all these new science coming out of the Grand Canyon. It's just such an iconic landscape because it keeps revealing new stories. And so that was obviously part of what appealed to me about this study and also the editors at High Country News, that this place that we've been talking about and people have been, at first bewildered by and then intrigued by, keeps delivering new stories. And that's obviously an amazing thing. Now, the Meteor Crater Link, in some ways, I mean, that's why I had this kind of funny quote. And I think, Lynn, you mentioned earlier, I forget, let's see, who said this? It was, it was Kyle House of the Arizona Geological Survey. He was like, you know, no way. How could it have taken this long to figure this out? And I kind of put that in there as humor, but it's true. This meteor impact 100 miles away, yeah, in a way, it seems almost intuitive that it would have shook the whole region and maybe caused a landslide, and that for decades we thought there was a lake. Well, why couldn't we have put these two together? Well, it takes technology, it takes things changing for us to be able to link events definitively and not just be waving our arms around and saying, well, maybe, but you need something convincing like these overlapping ages that really tie the history together. So yeah, the story keeps unfolding in an interesting way for me, at least.
And speaking of you, were there any personal findings in your reporting that generally surprised you?
Well, I mean, the lake thing to begin with, I'd never heard. I think that was probably the biggest surprise to me. I've always heard of the Grand Canyon as this passively eroding thing by a river. And that no, and sure, I could imagine some brief lakes here and there. I think I had maybe heard that, you know, so volcanic kind of basalt flows had dammed the river at times. I never understood those to be very big lakes. Perhaps my understanding was off and that they were. But this was a substantial lake that filled most of Marble Canyon. And it's kind of hard to imagine, if anyone ever gets a chance and drives over Lee's Ferry, to imagine that canyon filled with water, much like it to Lake Powell to your north. It's kind of hard to imagine. And to do so naturally is pretty impressive. So yeah, I was just surprised by the lake at all.
It's very surprising. And also the fact that it was on the Richter scale, maybe about 3.5. Is that right? That it, in the Marble Canyon area by the time, I think overall it was a 5.6?
Yeah, 5.4 at the impact site, which is kind of a model-based assumption of how much shake, earthquake equivalent shaking you would have got at the site. And then that ripples out, you know, 100 miles or so out to Marble Canyon and is down to about a 3.5. Yeah.
Right, which doesn't strike me as a very impactful shake.
No.
And so it does make me wonder about how many other areas along the Grand Canyon could it have dislodged significant chunks of rock and created other lakes along the way.
Yeah, you're right. So 3.5 magnitude, that's enough to be felt. Like that'll rattle your stuff in your house and you would know it. But that's a pretty standard earthquake for Southern California. I mean, people like that deal earthquakes like that all the time. So this is not like catastrophic, you know, like the Myanmar recent earthquake. This is nothing like that. It's enough to rattle the stuff in your house. But anyone who will tell you who's lived in the Southwest, it can be a beautiful bluebell day and all of a sudden just a cliff just lets loose. Like the Kaibab limestone on the top of the canyon is filled with fractures. It's prone to falling off and breaking. You don't need really anything. So yes, it's completely conceivable that a 3.5 could cause a landslide many places. So no one, you know, I talked to a seismologist, Ryan Porter at NAU, and he was like, oh, 100%, this is enough to shake loose a landslide. So they don't need any more than that. I guess the question is, could this landslide have just happen randomly? I mean, we just have random landslides all over the West. Sometimes they're related to high precipitation events. Sometimes they just happen. And so I don't think anyone is discounting the idea of a landslide. It's just the difficulty will always be tying it exactly to the meteor crater impact. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, it does. And actually that triggers a memory of a handful of years ago, probably 15 years ago now, in Rockville, Utah, just outside of Zion Park, heavy precipitation event, big rain over about a week, dislodged a huge chunk, came down and on top of a house, and just the house is gone.
It happens all the time. So it'll be a mystery of saying anyone could come in and say, hey, you can't prove that meteor impact caused that landslide. But Carlstrom says, hey, we've got the dates, they overlap. It's a conceivable explanation. And I think, and he would defend it as that and no more. He would not say this happened 100%.
Right.
I feel comfortable saying that for him. I hope he doesn't call me. Like,
well, I can see why you as a science writer with a geology background were really interested in writing about this. So Evan Howell, science writer at High Country News, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. It's really fascinating.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys.